Heretics, Chapter 18, The Fallacy of the Young Nation. To say that a man is an idealist is merely to say that he is a man. But nevertheless, it might be possible to effect some valid distinction between one kind of idealist and another. One possible distinction, for instance, could be effected by saying that humanity is divided into conscious idealists and unconscious idealists. In a similar way, humanity is divided into conscious ritualists and unconscious ritualists. The curious thing is, in that example, as in others, that it is the conscious ritualism which is comparatively simple, the unconscious ritual which is really heavy and complicated. The ritual which is comparatively rude and straightforward is the ritual which people call ritualistic. It consists of plain things like bread and wine and fire and men falling on their faces. But the ritual, which is really complex and many-colored and elaborate and needlessly formal, is a ritual which people enact without knowing it. It consists not only of things like wine and fire, but of really peculiar and local and exceptional and ingenious things. Things like doormats and door knockers and electric bells and silk hats and white ties and shiny cards and confetti. The truth is that the modern man scarcely ever gets back to very old and simple things, except when he is performing some religious mummery. The modern man can hardly get away from ritual except by entering a ritualistic church. In the case of these old and mystical formalities, we can at least say that the ritual is not mere ritual, that the symbols employed are in most cases symbols which belong to a primary human poetry. The most ferocious opponent of the Christian ceremonials must admit that if Catholicism had not instituted the bread and wine, somebody else would most probably have done so. Anyone with a poetical instinct will admit that to the ordinary human instinct, bread symbolizes something which cannot very easily be symbolized otherwise, that wine to the ordinary human instinct symbolizes something which cannot very easily be symbolized otherwise. But white ties in the evening are ritual, and nothing else but ritual. No one would pretend that white ties in the evening are primary and poetical. Nobody would maintain that the ordinary human instinct would in any age or country tend to symbolize the idea evening by a white necktie. Rather, the ordinary human instinct would, I imagine, tend to symbolize evening by cravats with some of the colors of the sunset, not white neckties but tawny or crimson neckties. Neckties of purple or olive, or some darkened gold. Mr. J. A. Kensett, for example, is under the impression that he is not a ritualist. But the daily life of Mr. J. A. Kensett, like that of any ordinary modern man, is, as a matter of fact, one continual and compressed catalog of mystical mummery and flummery. To take one instance out of an inevitable hundred, I imagine that Mr. Kensett takes off his hat to a lady. And what can be more solemn and absurd, considered in the abstract, than symbolizing the existence of the other sect by taking off a portion of your clothing and waving it in the air? This, I repeat, is not a natural and primitive symbol, like fire or food. A man might just as well have to take off his waistcoat to a lady, and if a man, by the social ritual of his civilization, had to take off his waistcoat to a lady, every chivalrous and sensible man would take off his waistcoat to a lady. In short, Mr. Kensett and those who agree with him may think, and quite sincerely think, that men give too much incense and ceremonial to their adoration of the other world. But nobody thinks that he can give too much incense and ceremonial to the adoration of this world. All men, then, are ritualists, but are either conscious or unconscious ritualists. The conscious ritualists are generally satisfied with a few very simple and elementary signs. The unconscious ritualists are not satisfied with anything short of the whole of human life, being almost insanely ritualistic. The first is called a ritualist because he invents and remembers one rite. The other is called an anti-ritualist because he obeys and forgets a thousand. And a somewhat similar distinction to this, which I have drawn with some unavoidable length, between the conscious ritualist and the unconscious ritualist, exists between the conscious idealist and the unconscious idealist. It is idle to inveigh against cynics and materialists. There are no cynics, there are no materialists. Every man is idealistic. Only it so often happens that he has the wrong idea. Every man is incurably sentimental, but unfortunately it is so often a false sentiment. When we talk, for instance, of some unscrupulous commercial figure and say that he would do anything for money, we use quite an inaccurate expression, and we slander him very much. He would not do anything for money. He would do some things for money. He would sell his soul for money, for instance. And, as Mirabeau humorously said, he would be quite wise to take money for muck. He would oppress humanity for money, but then it happens that humanity and the soul are not things that he believes in. They are not his ideals. But he has his own dim and delicate ideals, and he would not violate these for money. He would not drink out of the soup tureen for money. He would not wear his coattails in front for money. He would not spread a report that he had softening of the brain for money. In the actual practice of life, we find in the matter of ideals exactly what we have already found in the matter of ritual. We find that while there is a perfectly genuine danger of fanaticism for the men who have unworldly ideals, the permanent and urgent danger of fanaticism is from the men who have worldly ideals. People who say that an ideal is a dangerous thing, that it deludes and intoxicates, are perfectly right. But the ideal which intoxicates most is the least idealistic kind of ideal. The ideal which intoxicates least is very ideal ideal. That sobers us suddenly, as all heights and precipices and great distances do. Granted that it is a great evil to mistake a cloud for a cape, still the cloud, which can be most easily mistaken for a cape, is the cloud that is nearest the earth. Similarly, we may grant that it may be dangerous to mistake an ideal for something practical, but we shall still point out that in this respect, the most dangerous ideal of all is the ideal which looks a little practical. It is difficult to attain a high ideal. Consequently, it is almost impossible to persuade ourselves that we have attained it. But it is easy to attain a low ideal. Consequently, it is easier still to persuade ourselves that we have attained it when we have done nothing of the kind. To take a random example, it might be called a high ambition to wish to be an archangel. The man who entertained such an ideal would very possibly exhibit asceticism or even frenzy, but not, I think, delusion. He would not think he was an archangel and go about flapping his hands under the impression that they were wings. But suppose that a sane man had a low ideal. Suppose he wished to be a gentleman. Anyone who knows the world knows that in 9 weeks he would have persuaded himself that he was a gentleman. And this being manifestly not the case, the result will be very real and practical dislocations and calamities in social life. It is not the wild ideals which wreck the practical world. It is the tame ideals. The matter may perhaps be illustrated by a parallel from our modern politics. When men tell us that the old liberal politicians of the type of Gladstone cared only for ideals, of course they are talking nonsense. They cared for a great many other things, including votes. And when men tell us that modern politicians of the type of Mr. Chamberlain, or in another way Lord Rosebery, care only for votes or for material interest, then again they are talking nonsense. These men care for ideals like all other men. But the real distinction which may be drawn in this, that to the older politician the ideal was an ideal and nothing else. To the new politician, his dream is not only a good dream, it is a reality. The old politician would have said, it would be a good thing if there were a Republican Federation dominating the world. But the modern politician does not say, it would be a good thing if there were a British imperialism dominating the world. He says, it is a good thing that there is a British imperialism dominating the world, whereas clearly there is nothing of the kind. The old liberal would say, there ought to be a good Irish government in Ireland. But the ordinary modern unionist does not say, there ought to be a good English government in Ireland. He says, there is a good English government in Ireland, which is absurd. In short, the modern politicians seem to think that a man becomes practical merely by making assertions entirely about practical things. Apparently, a delusion does not matter as long as it is a materialistic delusion. Instinctively, most of us feel that as a practical matter, even the contrary is true. I certainly would much rather share my apartments with a gentleman who thought he was God than with a gentleman who thought he was a grasshopper. To be continually haunted by practical images and practical problems, to be constantly thinking of things as actual, as urgent, as in process of completion, these things do not prove a man to be practical. These things, indeed, are among the most ordinary signs of a lunatic. That our modern statesmen are materialistic is nothing against their being also morbid. Seeing angels in a vision may make a man a supernaturalist to excess, but merely seeing snakes in delirium tremens does not make him a naturalist. And when we come actually to examine the main stock notions of our modern practical politicians, we find that those main stock notions are mainly delusions. A great many instances might be given of the fact. We might take, for example, the case of that strange class of notions which underlie the word union, and all the eulogies heaped upon it. Of course, union is no more a good thing in itself than separation is a good thing in itself. To have a party in favor of union and a party in favor of separation is as absurd as to have a party in favor of going upstairs and a party in favor of going downstairs. The question is not whether we go up or downstairs, but where are we going to and what we are going for. Union is strength. Union is also weakness. It is a good thing to harness two horses to a cart, but it is not a good thing to try and turn two hansom cabs into one four-wheeler. Turning 10 nations into one empire may happen to be as feasible as turning 10 shillings into one half-sovereign. Also, it may happen to be as preposterous as turning 10 terriers into one mastiff. The question in all cases is not a question of union or absence of union, but of identity or absence of identity. Owing to certain historical and moral causes, two nations may be so united as upon the whole to help each other. Thus, England and Scotland pass their time in paying each other compliments, but their energies and atmospheres run distinct and parallel and consequently do not clash. Scotland continues to be educated and Calvinistic. England continues to be uneducated and happy. But owing to certain other moral and certain other political causes, two nations may be so united as only to hamper each other. Their lines do clash and do not run parallel. Thus, for instance, England and Ireland are so united that the Irish can sometimes rule England, but can never rule Ireland. The educational systems, including the last Education Act, are here, as in the case of Scotland, a very good test of the matter. The overwhelming majority of Irishmen believe in a strict Catholicism. The overwhelming majority of Englishmen believe in a vague Protestantism. The Irish party in the Parliament of Union is just large enough to prevent the English education being indefinitely Protestant, and just small enough to prevent the Irish education being definitely Catholic. Here we have a state of things which no man in his senses would ever dream of wishing to continue if he had not been bewitched by the sentimentalism of the mere word, union.